This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. 2008 is not here yet. It just seems that way because presidential hopefuls have been campaigning in some form or other for more than a year already. The candidates' first tests come in early January with the Iowa caucuses on the 3rd and the New Hampshire primary on the 8th. So the candidates have been putting in a lot of face time in those states, and this hour, Word for Word, will present some of what they've been saying. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll play excerpts from their stump speeches in Iowa and New Hampshire. It's your chance to hear how the candidates have been presenting themselves and their platforms on the campaign trail. Next week, we'll hear from the Democratic candidates. This week, it's the Republicans. You will hear them in alphabetical order. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, Senator John McCain of Arizona, Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, Congressman Tom Tancredo of Colorado, and Fred Thompson, formerly a senator from Tennessee. We begin with Rudy Giuliani. Speaking last month in Manchester, New Hampshire, Giuliani said his experience as mayor of New York City has prepared him for the presidency.
I ran a city that was the size of a state. It would have been like the 12th or 13th largest state, the third largest number of employees of any government in the country, the 17th largest economy in the world. And I ran it during difficult times. Budget crisis, economic crisis, welfare crisis, 1.1 million people on welfare, double-digit unemployment, loss of 300,000 to 400,000 jobs, and massive crime. And I go ask you to look at the results that I got. Crime reduced by numbers that nobody ever thought were possible and nobody else ever did before or since. Welfare reduced by more than anyone else ever did, by numbers that no one could have believed possible when we started. 640,000 fewer people on welfare. That is larger than the population of most cities in the country. The unemployment rate went from 10.5 to 5%. The number of jobs went from a net loss of 350,000 to a net gain of 450,000. And I can go on and on, but there are two things that I think tell you the whole story. One thing is that change in hopefulness and hopelessness. People, all of a sudden, starting to believe in themselves, starting to believe that government can actually work at a certain level, that it isn't all just a big joke and people just say things to you and they don't accomplish anything. And that's the kind of thing we have to restore for the federal government. We can make it work. If we promise you unrealistic solutions, we then play into your cynicism. If I promise you some of the things like the Democrats do, universal health care for everyone, and it won't cost much. When health care becomes free, you will find out how expensive it really becomes and how deteriorated and how dilapidated and how horrible and how bad. Because, ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing for free. If our goal is we want to reduce cost in order to create dramatically more access, and we want to at least maintain or improve quality, then big government mandate that requires you to have health insurance and fines you if you don't have it, or taxes you if you don't have it, you will lose control of the cost of that. And that's what I mean by a socialist solution. It's the government commanding, demanding, imposing, requiring. Every time that happens, cost goes up, quality goes down. So big tax deduction will allow a tremendous market for private insurance. By every American that buys private insurance, then when it starts to be a million more and 2 million and 10 and 15 and 20 and 30, we'll drive down the cost. So that's one of the things that I think we can accomplish. And that comes about from the ideas that I have for the future, but also from my prior experience of actually having run something. How do we end illegal immigration? We end it at the border. Only place you can do it. That comes from my experience of having been in the Justice Department, comes from my experience of being mayor. There's nothing anti-immigrant at all, or harsh, or cruel in saying, if you want to come into the United States of America, you must identify yourself. Why didn't we do it in the past? Well, maybe we couldn't do it in the past. Our borders are huge. The technology didn't exist back in the 70s and the 80s, certainly, to do it. Not even sure it existed in the 90s. The technology exists now to do it. We'd build a fence, but it would be mostly a technological fence. You have to have a physical fence in cities and places. It works. But really, the core of it is a technological fence. The technological fence is basically photographic equipment, motion detection equipment, heat-seeking equipment. Basically, the sum of it is you have equipment that alerts you to people approaching the border. You then deploy your border patrol across the border, roughly 50-mile intervals, substations, and then that equipment alerts them to people coming over the border. You then deploy them to that area, and since they're 50-mile intervals, they're no more than about 25, 30 miles from any point on the border. So you can bring together two substations or three or four, and you stop the people from coming in. You don't let them come in the first place. Send them back. And you do strategic redeployment of the Border Patrol to areas maybe where you fail to stop people from coming in, or areas that seem to be the most popular areas to come in. That's kind of how we reduce crime. It was all strategic projection of where crime would take place. And then most of the time being right about it. Not always. And then we would have a tamper-proof ID card for people who come into the country legally. Meaning one card, not six, with your picture on it, biometric identification. And people say, oh, that's impossible. How can you, so many people come in? How can you do that? Well, the technology exists to do it. The political will has to be there to do it. And the leadership has to be there to do it. And that's why I'm running for president, because I know how to do these things. I know how to get big tasks accomplished. Look at what I did about organized crime as United States attorney. Look what we did about political corruption in New York City. Go back and look at what we did about drugs when I was in the Reagan administration. And go look at what I did about during the time that I was mayor of New York City. I did things of that scope. And finally, what are we really trying to do with illegal immigration? Honestly, what we're really trying to do is change behavior. We're trying to teach people, we want you to come in legally. You don't have to come in illegally. We want you to go to some place and at an office, get a card, come in legally. We got to make that possible. We got to make that easier. We're not a country that wants to shut people out. We want people to come in. If we don't, we're making a big mistake. We need new people. We do. We're at virtual full employment right now. It's not distributed uniformly all over the country the way it should be, and there are a lot of things we can do to work on that. But if we think of ourselves as one big country, we're at below 5% unemployment. We got lots of needs. We have lots of needs at all levels. We have specialized needs at upper economic levels. We have major needs at entry-level jobs, and we want those people to come in. I want them here. There are some people who don't. I want them here. But I want them to come in legally. I want them to come in. I want to get identified, their picture, their biometric data, have them pay taxes. Let's bring them into a healthy environment instead of this terrible underground environment that exists. Not good for them, not good for us. The only reason people are hanging on to this is because, honestly, I'll tell you the truth, and I listen to those Democrats talk about it all the time. They talk about the romance of change. They've never changed anything. They don't know how to change anything. When you haven't run a city, you haven't run a state, you haven't run a business, you've never done change, and you're 40 or 50 or 60 years old, it's all political rhetoric. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Republican presidential candidate and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani speaking November 5th in Manchester, New Hampshire. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. And this hour, we're featuring highlights from the Republican presidential candidates on the stump in Iowa and New Hampshire. We'll be hearing from the Democrats next week. As we proceed in alphabetical order, we hear next from former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee in an appearance in Concord, New Hampshire on November 30th.
We face many crises in this country, and the one at the border is certainly one of them. The threat that we have from radical Islamic jihadism is a real one. But I want to speak to the fact that that's not the only threat we face. The threat that perhaps is as great is the threat that we would lose our own internal soul. First of all, that sense of resilience and optimism that's given our country, the kind of capacity to get through not only its revolution, but to get through a civil war and world wars and a Great Depression, and to be able, through every one of those crises, to come forth not only surviving, but actually stronger and more defined as a people in a quest for freedom. That's threatened today. It's threatened by a political system that's completely off base. We have too many people who think horizontally. We need to be thinking vertically. Are we going up or are we going down? And deal with the problems on that basis. For example, we are a nation that needs to decide that it's going to be energy independent, not just for environmental reasons, not just for national security reasons and economic reasons, but for all of those reasons. We currently finance both sides of the war on terror. Every time we pay taxes, we pay for the military side of our war. But every time we put our credit card in the gas pump, we're helping the House of Saud become a little bit more obscenely rich and finance the Wahhabism and the madrasas that train the terrorists, 15 of which came from Saudi Arabia. Why we continue to allow ourselves to be enslaved and held hostage to them is beyond me. Why we don't have the capacity to speak out more forcefully when a 19-year-old is raped brutally and then she is charged with a crime. Can you imagine the outrage in our country should some incredible injustice like that happen? And our response nationally is rather tepid because we're afraid to offend? Imagine the different dynamics in this country and across the world if within 10 years we could tell the Saudis that we needed their oil no more than we needed their sand, and we asked them to keep both of them, because we would be energy independent with our own environmentally friendly, self-sufficient, and sustainable energy sources. Frankly, I'd like to be the president that one day would have it so that our grandchildren would laugh at us when we tell them we used to have to put our toothpaste in plastic bags and take our shoes off to get on an airplane, just like my children laugh at me when I tell them about the days of the Cold War when I was in grade school in Hope, Arkansas, and we used to practice duck and cover. I'd like for future generations to find that we've done a better job of building our nation so that future generations don't have the same fears and anxieties that we have to have because of the threats that are against us. We have a healthcare system that's completely upside down, and it's got to be addressed. And the problem with our current system, it's based on intervention at the point of catastrophic disease. If we're going to have a real healthcare system, it's got to be based on prevention before the disease ever becomes catastrophic. The current direction in which we're going is unsustainable from an economic perspective. We already are at the point where we spend almost 17% of our gross domestic product in this country on healthcare, which is more than anybody else on the planet. Switzerland is at 10.5%, so that's second place. Now, to put that in perspective, at 17%, that's more than four times the entire defense budget, including the war in Iraq. We so spend disproportionately on health care that at the current rate, we'll be spending 20% of our gross domestic product on it by the year 2015. And the real tragedy of the $2 trillion that represents, 80%, now think about this, 80% of it relates to chronic disease. So what we really have is not a health care crisis. What we have is a health crisis. And until we begin to address that, all we're going to do by the talk of expanding coverage and making sure that everybody can get more access to the system, which isn't a system, it's a maze. But when we talk about access to the system, if we don't start changing the system from within, making it prevention rather than intervention based, the only thing that universal coverage will do is accelerate the rate at which we will bankrupt the nation. Universal coverage is not only a laudable goal, it is a necessary one. But only as it's being done in conjunction with a completely different approach to a prevention-based healthcare system so that we focus on the prevention of the disease rather than simply treating it after it's out of control. It would make more sense to cover the visit to the nutritionist than it would to wait until the person needs a quadruple bypass. But today's system doesn't do that, in part because it's built on a post-World War II model that ties health coverage to employment and that has a third-party payer. And when you take out the consumer and the provider and you take their relationship away and you put the payment in the hands of a third party and the ownership in the hands of a third party, and the insurance company is tied to the employer, not to the consumer, you create an upside-down model that'll never work, in part because insurance companies don't insure prevention for a reason. Some say because they're mean and they're greedy. Well, that's one view of it. If you'll talk to the actuaries of the companies, they'll tell you that the reason is because people change jobs every few years. And the likelihood that you're going to be insured by your same carrier now as you will in 7 years is remote. Chances are a different carrier will own your insurance 7 years from now than who owns it today. And insurance companies know that the real payoff for preventive health is 6 to 8 years out. So if they cover you on the prevention side now, all they're going to do is make you less expensive for their competitor, and they're not going to gain a penny out of it. So it's a business decision. It's not one of cold-heartedness. So what we've got to do is to change the model so it makes financial sense not only for the company, but it makes financial sense for the consumer, and that you get financial benefits for actually taking better care of yourself. What a novel idea, that consumers would be rewarded for responsible behavior. Isn't that radical? But it's the only thing that'll save health care in this country. And so when people say, Governor, tell me, what do you think is the most important problem the next president's going to face? I don't give them an issue. I say it's the real problem is a crisis of confidence in our country and in our government again. As far as the issues, they're integrated. I learned as a governor, there's not a way to compartmentalize and separate each of the issues you face. They really are integrated and tied together. And when you begin to see the landscape is a marvelous capacity to drive the same vehicle, but to realize there are many gauges to look at on the dashboard, we might actually meet our destination. And that's what we're going to have to do in this country, is to show the leadership where we don't just simply look at one gauge to the exclusion of the others, but we look at all the gauges to make sure that we're going in a healthy direction with a healthy vehicle, but at the same time that we never forget that the goal is to do what our founding fathers had a simple dream of, and that is a society in which we would never forget that we were created equal and that we would be given the opportunity to pursue our life, our liberty, and our pursuit of happiness. Thank all of you for letting me be with you.
Republican presidential candidate and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee on the campaign trail last month in Concord, New Hampshire. I'm Melinda Pencava. Today on Word for Word, we're featuring the Republican presidential candidates on the stump in New Hampshire and Iowa. We'll have the Democrats next week. We made numerous efforts to acquire a stump speech from California Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter, but his campaign did not return repeated emails and phone calls. According to a database of campaign events maintained by the Washington Post, Hunter has been waging a far less active campaign than his rivals. He made fewer than 30 appearances in Iowa and half as many in New Hampshire. Most of the events did not feature speeches. Author Alan Keyes has also declared himself a candidate for the Republican nomination, although that same Washington Post database says Keyes has held only 4 campaign events total nationwide. None of them were in Iowa or New Hampshire. So, proceeding alphabetically with our stump speeches, we move on to Arizona Senator John McCain. McCain, a strong and early proponent of President Bush's troop buildup in Iraq, spoke this summer in Concord, New Hampshire.
I want to talk today about the national security challenge of our time, the war which radical extremists of Islam have been waging against us for the better part of 3 decades, and in which Iraq, according to the commander of our forces there, General Petraeus, and our enemies, is the central front in the war on terror today. You know, my friends, my father's generation successfully fought the Second World War and the Korean War. Succeeding American generations fought in the Cold War. And my friends, we will successfully defend ourselves against this new and very dangerous threat. But as we've done in the past, we must not take counsel of our fears, nor avert our eyes from the imminence and complexity of the threat, nor let our will sacrifice weaken, because we've already made sacrifices, and the false assumptions and tactical mistakes we have made in Iraq and in the wider struggle against enemies who are as determined to harm us as we must be to defeat them. Most Americans only became acutely aware of the threat from Islamic extremists on September 11, 2001. The worst attack ever on American soil brought out the best of America as we came together to defend our freedom. We went on the offensive, capturing and killing terrorists all over the world, rooting them out of their lairs in Afghanistan and overthrowing their Taliban collaborators. Many today say that we are losing the war with Islamic extremists. I disagree. We have disrupted numerous plots to attack our homeland and our allies. Working with allies, we have captured or killed scores of major terrorist leaders. But there's much more that needs to be done. Osama bin Laden and his deputy remain at large, and we cannot rest until they are captured or killed. Al-Qaeda remains operational, with franchises sprouting around the world. The outcome in Iraq and Afghanistan, to be blunt, is uncertain. Today, our goal must be to effectively counter the plans of our enemies, not simply with military force, but with all the other tools at our disposal, economic, diplomatic, political, legal, and ideological. We must not only track down and capture or kill confirmed jihadists, we must stop a new generation from joining the fight. The long war is not with Islam, but within Islam. A small minority of extremists against the majority of moderates. My administration would pour forth far more resources into helping moderate Muslims, women's rights campaigners, labor leaders, tolerant imams, lawyers, journalists, and many others resist a well-financed campaign of extremism that is tearing their societies apart. We need not fear democracy in the Muslim world. But as you know, and we have learned to our sorrow, there's much more to democracy than simply voting. Democracy is grounded in a functioning and impartial judiciary and police force, a free press, a robust political opposition, respect for women's rights and minority rights, and other essential elements we often take for granted. We must press friendly Muslim states, not simply to open the ballot box, but to establish the building blocks of an open and tolerant society. Defeatism will not buy peace in our time. It will only lead to more bloodshed and to more American casualties in the future. If we choose to lose in Iraq, our enemies will hit us harder in Afghanistan, helping to erode our political will, and will encourage calls in Western capitals for withdrawal and accommodation with our enemy there as well. There's much we need to do at home. We need to make far-reaching reforms to our government. The nature of the threat confronting America changed radically between the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Twin Towers. And yet our governmental structures have not kept pace. No one who has visited our servicemen and women in Iraq or Afghanistan can doubt their skills, their bravery, or their dedication. But it is equally impossible to doubt that, as I have said for years, they are overstretched and under-resourced. I'm glad to see the troop increases are in the pipeline, but current plans are not enough. As president, I would bring the Army and Marines from the currently planned level of roughly 750,000 to 900,000. This will cost real money, my friends, some $15 billion annually. But it will not require a draft any more than similar levels did in the 1980s. Along with more military personnel, the military will require additional equipment for the expanded force, to modernize for the future, and to make up the losses suffered in the current wars. We can partially offset some of this additional investment by cutting wasteful spending, including unnecessary Pentagon programs and an often totally dysfunctional procurement system. But we can also afford to spend more on our defense. Our defense budget currently consumes less than 4 cents of every dollar that our booming economy generates, far less than we spent during the Cold War. We must understand that we confront a lengthy struggle, a long war, that will not be won quickly or easily, but we will win it. While our ultimate victory is not in doubt, the length and intensity of this struggle remain to be determined. It is up to us. It's up to us. We have historically important choices to make, all of us, the American people, their president, and their members of Congress. We must recognize that our enemies are in this fight to win, and so we must be also. We must use our strengths, our resources, our inventiveness, and our fortitude, qualities that have distinguished us through history and which have never failed us, to defeat our unpardonable foe. We must act boldly and with confidence that history has not yet assigned us a challenge that we cannot meet successfully. Though we regret the mistakes we have made in this war, they must not cause us self-doubt. We must learn from them, as Americans have always learned from our mistakes, and fight smarter and harder. Though we mourn the losses we have already incurred in this war, we must not let our grief weary us so that we cannot do the work that is ours to do. These are the decisions confronting American voters in this election, and they will confront the person you elect as president. In November 2008, the American people will decide with their votes how and where this war will be fought, or if it will be fought at all. I've told you how I intend to fight this war. Other candidates will argue for a different course. Democratic candidates for president will argue for the course of cutting our losses and withdrawing from the threat in the vain hope it will not follow us here. I cannot join them in such wishful and very dangerous thinking. Peace at any price is an illusion, and its costs are always more tragic than the sacrifices that victory requires. I will stand where I stand today and trust you to give me a fair hearing. There's too much at stake in this election for any candidate to do less. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Arizona Senator John McCain, who is seeking the Republican nomination for president, speaking this summer in Concord, New Hampshire. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Next up this hour, as we feature highlights from the Republican presidential candidate's stump speeches, we hear from Texas Republican Congressman Ron Paul. Paul, who ran for president under the Libertarian Party banner back in 1988, gave this speech in front of an enthusiastic crowd in Manchester, New Hampshire, this September.
I get asked at times by those in the media that, we know what you're against the war, you're against this and that. What are you for? Well, you want the government to do something? Yes, we do. We want our government to do the proper things that are authorized in the Constitution. The most important thing about the Constitution, the purpose of the Constitution, was to restrict the government, not the people. It's supposed to provide a strong national defense. Our national defense actually is weakened because of the way we run our foreign policy. It's supposed to protect the borders. No, the borders are unprotected and totally ignored. The government is supposed to give us sound money. Gold and silver is legal tender. No, they give us paper money, which is counterfeit. They're supposed to protect property rights. No, they tear up property rights with eminent domain. They don't even let us use our property. We're not even allowed to use our property without about 25 permits. So who owns the property? We should own it, not the government. How are we supposed to sort out our problems, social and also in the economic sphere? It's supposed to be solved with private personal contracts, voluntary agreements. The government has a responsibility to enforce those contracts. But today, the contracts are dictated to us by the government, whether who you hire and who you fire and how much you pay and who can come into your buildings. And now we have so many. Can you imagine what the founders would think about how many people we have today harassing us? We have over 100,000 federal agents now who carry guns to harass the people. It should be the other way around. They advised against a standing army, but it looks like today we have a standing army of bureaucrats. This is the only place where I think we should have gun control. Take the guns away from the bureaucrats. You know, so we understand, I think, the problems that we face. I think we all understand really how we got here by ignoring the Constitution. And that means that there's not a difficult problem in figuring out what we ought to do. Let's just restore the rule of law and believe in the Constitution and follow it. Yeah. Now, the one thing that the campaign so far has convinced me of is I've never been hesitant to say that I was very reluctant. I had to be talked into thinking there would be enough of you that would be interested, that I was convinced there were still too few of us and we still needed another generation for education. But the educational process, which is always necessary for a significant change in attitude for a country, has occurred. It has occurred. Our job is to popularize the ideas and that people get to the point where they will and they always do vote in their own self-interest. If they think that they can continue to vote for that government that solves all their problems like they did in New Orleans, then they'll vote the other way. But the evidence is so clear, whether it's monetary or foreign policy or economics, it's a total failure. So now we're at this point that we are just seeing this tremendous rise of this enthusiasm, and I believe it is going to continue. It is people like you that have done this and brought it together, and I think it just may be at the very beginning, and who knows what's going to happen in the next several months. But let me just close by saying, I am not a prophet. I don't know what's happening. I've been talking this way for 30 years, but something special is happening. And since I don't know the future, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't even know if the media will cover us today. Who knows? But we will be significant. And if we do that job, and we don't know, and the outcome is who knows what, but I do know one thing. This movement and this understanding and the need for this spirit of America, the spirit of freedom, is alive and well, and it will continue regardless of what happens on Election Day. But I thank you very much for all your enthusiasm and all this energy. Thank you.
Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul, a congressman from Texas, speaking in September in Manchester, New Hampshire. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. This week on Word for Word, we're featuring highlights from the Republican presidential candidate's stump speeches. Next week, we'll hear from the Democratic candidates. Right now, though, we'll hear from former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, speaking August 10th at the Iowa State Fair.
When I became governor, there were some things I wanted to do. I wanted to balance our budget without raising taxes, and I did that. I wanted to do a better job for our kids. We had a lot of kids that wanted to get into college, and they had to pass an exam to graduate from high school, but they wanted some help getting into college, and so I fought for something known as the Adams Scholarship. In my state now, if you graduate in the top quarter of your high school class, you're entitled to 4 years tuition-free at our state university or state colleges. Now, that's not entirely free because fees are even higher, but it's a huge commitment to education. And then we fought for health care. I was concerned that we had a lot of people in our state that didn't have health insurance. And that's not good for them, and it's not good for you. It's not good for them, of course, because if they get sick, they tend to go to the emergency room to get care, and that's expensive, and it comes at a time when their condition has become acute. Been better if they'd have gotten preventative care. It's not good for you, because if they go to the hospital to get treated, guess who pays? They can't, because they don't have insurance. So you have to in your taxes or in the premiums you pay. And so I said, let's find a way to help these folks get insurance. But I don't want the government to take over health care. I don't want the guys who ran the Katrina cleanup running my health care. Let's instead find a way to get everybody private, market-based insurance. Those people that don't have it, let's get the premiums down so they're more affordable. For the poor who can't even afford it then, let's help them buy their insurance. Let them own it. And we found out it was less expensive for us to help people buy insurance than it was just to give out free care in the hospitals. But the key thing is this. We got the job done. We just didn't talk about how it'd be nice to do things in the future. We actually got the job done. And if there's ever been a time to actually get the job done in Washington, it's now. Now, we face some great challenges. But this nation is, in many respects, the hope of the world. And it's essential that this nation deal with our challenges. In my view, the Republican Party, which I represent, and many of you do as well, is a party which stands for strength. We believe the best ally peace has ever known is a strong America. And if we want to overcome the challenges we face, we want to see a strong military so we can stand and protect our rights. We want to see a strong economy to provide the jobs that we and our kids deserve. And we want strong families. I want to have more troops in our military. I think we ought to add at least 100,000 troops, and I believe we need to give them the equipment they need on the battlefield and the care they deserve when they get home. I want to see a stronger economy by lowering taxes. I have a new tax rate, by the way. For middle-income Americans and modest-income Americans, when they earn their interest check from the bank or when they get the check from their mutual fund or their dividends and capital gains, I think the tax rate ought to be absolutely zero. They ought to be able to save their money and not have to get taxed again. Because I don't think it's fair that you get taxed when you earn your money, taxed when you save your money, and taxed when you die. I want to end the death tax, too. So a strong military, a strong economy, and strong families. And I got a lot of young people here, so I'm going to take an occasion just to talk about one thing for a moment that can strengthen our families. And that is, before you think about having kids, plan on getting married. It's a huge advantage to have a mom and a dad associated with the development of a child. It's a great advantage for a child at the beginning of life, at least, to have a mom and a dad that can contribute to them with their time and their energy and also with their resources. There's another thing I'd like to do for our families, and that is I'd like to clean up the water of filth that a lot of our kids swim in, the pornography and the sex and the violence and the perversions. I want to make sure every computer sold in this country has a place where parents can block all that sort of stuff from coming off the Internet. I want to enforce our obscenity laws, and I want to make sure that people who are predators on kids know that in this country, it's one strike in your hours. One strike and you go to jail for a long, long time. And if you ever get out, you're going to be wearing one of those GPS ankle bracelets so you can never abuse a child again. Jessica? Well, I want to tell you, I'm optimistic about America's future. And the reason for that is because of the people I meet all over the country and all over the world. I had the fun of running the Olympic Games. I used to think that was just going to be a sporting event. It was a lot more than that. I got to meet people of a community, some 23,000 strong, that volunteered and made that a great success. As a governor, I got the chance to go off to Iraq and Afghanistan. Boy, that's an experience. Do we have anybody here who served in Iraq or Afghanistan? I don't see. Here's a hand right here. Thank you, sir, for your service. Where were you? In Iraq? In Iraq. Boy, it is hot there. This is a cool day in Baghdad. 135 degrees, I'm told, it gets in Baghdad. I was there about a year ago. And when I'd see troops from my own state of Massachusetts, I'd say to them, take out a piece of paper or a card and write down your contact information back home. And when I get home, I'll call your mom or your dad or your loved one, your wife or a husband. And when I left Iraq, I had 93 pieces of paper, 93 homes to call. And so on Memorial Day morning, when I got back, I started calling. And I got to about the fourth home, and the woman who answered the phone said, oh, Governor Romney, I thought that might be you calling. And I said, what do you mean you thought it might be me calling? Why do you say that? She said, well, you called this first spouse, and then she emailed her husband in Afghanistan and said you were calling. And then he emailed his buddies in the theater and told them you were calling. And then they emailed their spouses back home and said to expect your phone call today. So I called 93 homes that day, and it was inspiring. Every single home I called was proud to see a loved one serving in the armed forces and protecting this country. I didn't hear a single complaint. I'd express my appreciation for their sacrifice, and they'd say, no, Governor, it's an honor to be able to serve this great country, which is the hope of the earth. And then I went from those calls to a Republican convention in Idaho, and I spoke with the Republicans there, and I met the Republican National Committee man from Idaho named Blake Hall. And Blake told me about his six kids. He said his oldest son was in Iraq, and he got hit by one of those improvised explosive devices. And he said the shrapnel went into his head. He got a Purple Heart, and they brought him back here for 1 year of rehabilitation. But he said, Mitt, the good news is he's completely rehabilitated. He's completely recovered. I said, that's wonderful. What's he doing now? He said, oh, he signed up to go back again. This is a great land. This is a great country with wonderful people. It is that love of this country, that love of freedom, that love of strength, that willingness to have a strong military, to have a strong economy, and to build strong families that will keep us the strong nation we have always been and the hope of the world. That's what my campaign is about. I'm not a lifelong politician. I spent my life raising a family, living in the private sector, and I want to take the things I've learned to Washington to get the job done, to finally get our people insured, to improve our schools, to keep our taxes down, to keep our spending down, to become more competitive globally, to finally win the battle against these jihadists. I will do it with your help. Thank you so very much. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, one of the Republican presidential candidates, speaking in August at the Iowa State Fair. The next candidate we'll hear from is Colorado Congressman Tom Tancredo, who has built his campaign around the issue of illegal immigration. Here's Congressman Tancredo speaking earlier this year in Somersworth, New Hampshire.
If we have the rule of law as a basic tenet, then how in the world can we ignore the fact that millions and millions of people have broken the law by coming into this country without our permission? Now let me tell you, the word amnesty, it's one of those words that is often defined by the person using it. There are euphemisms used instead of the word amnesty. Regularization is one, or pathway to citizen. All these other words that they try to use in order to avoid using the word amnesty. Because amnesty, everybody, well, most people believe is a bad idea. I happen to be one of those people. No matter how you want to dress it up, no matter how you try to obfuscate, if you tell people who are in this country illegally that they can stay here, you are providing amnesty. Done. Period. That's the end of the story. Now you have, I mean, it may be something you want to do, but I will tell you right now, we tried it. 1986, we tried the exact same thing. We said, you know what, we've got so many people here, and we'll cut this deal. We'll actually start to enforce the law, and then we'll give people amnesty here, and then we'll concentrate on securing our borders, and we'll get Mexico to help us stop this flow and everything. Well, so we passed an amnesty. Did any of those things that were promised emanate out of that amnesty? Of course not. It was just the opposite. Naturally, if you reward any behavior, you're going to get more of it. If you reward people for coming into this country illegally, guess what you're going to get? And guess what we got? I'm going to suggest we do something very controversial. Three words. Enforce the law. Enforce the law. Secure the border. We can do it. Don't let people suggest that we can't do it. And by the way, we need more than a virtual fence. A virtual fence is fine for a virtual country trying to defend itself against virtual terrorists. But if you really want to do something, you have to have a real fence. Along with that, I'm not against virtual fencing. I'm just telling you that can't be the whole thing. We can secure our borders, but we choose not to. Really, if you can stop the hiring of people who are here illegally, that you will see by attrition, millions of people will leave. And they will leave because, frankly, the thing for which they came, the job, is no longer available. You don't have to, quote, round people up. You don't have to do any of that stuff. Millions will leave. They will go back. Somebody's asked me the other day, well, how are they going to get back? Well, the same way they got here. However they got here, there would be a, believe me, if there's a market for people to be brought in, and if you, then there's enough people trying to leave, there's a market for people trying to leave. They can get out themselves. Those that do not.
Give them a ride out.
They give them a ride. Yeah, that's right. I'm sure there'll be no problem getting people out should they want to leave. The people who don't leave, though, people who choose not to leave, yes, you have to enforce the law. It's called deportation. And when people say to you things like, well, you can't deport these people, you just can't deport, and then they go on, they just leave it there all the time, go, well, you can't deport them, you have to stop them and say, why not? It is the law. It is the law.
Republican presidential candidate Tom Tancredo, a Colorado congressman speaking earlier this year in Somersworth, New Hampshire. This hour on Word for Word, we're featuring highlights from the Republican presidential candidates on the stump in New Hampshire and Iowa. We'll be doing a similar program with the Democratic candidates next week. Finally this hour, we'll hear from Republican presidential candidate Fred Thompson, a former Tennessee senator and an actor best known for his work on the TV series Law and Order. Thompson didn't officially enter the race until September, but that didn't stop him from making a stump speech at the Iowa State Fair in August.
There are a lot of issues we could talk about. Goodness knows we're not bereft of issues to talk about. But I think of three things that to me kind of underlie everything else. First one has to do with national security, something that's been something that I've worked with and on and in the Intelligence Committee in the Senate and since then for a long time. And I'll simply say this at this point. I don't think that our nation has yet, as a nation, come to terms with the nature of the threat that's facing us in the global war against radical Islamic fundamentalism. In terms of the time it's going to take, in terms of the money and the resources from our treasury it's going to take, in terms of rebuilding our military, which is stretched way too thin, replacing our equipment, and all the things it's going to take, I don't think we've come to terms with that yet as a nation. We haven't had the discussion that we need to have about the fact that Iraq is a part of this problem. It's not the whole problem. And we're dealing with folks that want to bring us to our knees and bring Western civilization to our knees, and we have to be stronger and tougher and more united than they are, the way Americans have been all throughout our history. The second thing I think of has to do with our economy. It underlies everything else. To make a long story short, we are in the process of gradually bankrupting future generations in this country. Now, I'm not the first one to say this. I may be the first politician who wants to talk about it, because everybody asks, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And people are afraid of it. But it's an absolute fact. You look at the government reports, the General Accountability Office put out another one earlier this year. The Treasury Department has sent up warning signals with regard to Medicare and what's happening and so forth. We are clearly, and everybody in Washington knows this, going to be facing, with the retirement of the baby boomers just right around the corner and the rising medical costs, we're going to be facing a sea of red ink and government deficits and government debts is going to ruin this economy and not only jeopardize our entitlement programs, but it's going to jeopardize the future of the next generation. The third thing, when we look to Washington, these are Washington problems. Now, I'm a Federalist. I believe that the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and all of the amendments, including the Second Amendment, including the Tenth Amendment, are just as applicable today as that they've ever been. But there are certainly... But there are certain things that are responsibility of the federal government. When I look to Washington, I see a Congress that's more bitterly divided, more acrimonious, more prone to fight over everything, large and small, that has all their energy directed inward toward each other and toward the White House, and totally out of touch with the American people. I think, if nothing else proves it, the immigration bill and the fact that they were surprised at the reaction they got prove it more than anything else. And speaking of that, when you look at governmental functions, we see for the first time in our history this clearly, that the government can't any longer do some basic things that the government is supposed to do. We're seeing problems. Everybody knows about problems with Katrina, and everybody knows about procurement issues with regard to Iraq and all of that. Tip of the iceberg, my friends. We've got a bunch of folks are in over their head in some key positions. We've got computers that won't talk to each other. We've got departments that can't pass an audit. And all of this now is coming home to roost and affecting our national security. Now, as you might guess, if you know anything about my record, my answer to these things is not big government solutions and more bureaucracy and higher taxes. It's just the opposite. We need to get back to first principles. The declaration that I mentioned, the fact that our main laws come from God and not from any kind of government. Our Constitution, which has got the separation of powers and checks and balances and federalist system of government, for one reason mainly, and that is to ensure the freedom of the American people. We need to treasure that, remember that, rely upon that, and the underlying institutions, such as respect for private property, respect for market economy, along with individual rights, a respect for the value of free and fair competition, not only among our people, but with other nations in the world. Those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. I am unabashedly pro-life. I am pro-Second Amendment. And I don't apologize for the United States of America. This country has shed more blood for the freedom of other people than all the other nations in the history of the world combined, and I'm tired of people feeling like they've got to apologize for America. I think we can do something good for America. Thank you very much.
Republican presidential hopeful Fred Thompson, a former Tennessee senator and actor familiar to fans of the television drama Law and Order, Thompson spoke in August at the Iowa State Fair, the month before he officially declared his candidacy. This hour on Word for Word, we have featured highlights from the Republican presidential candidates on the stump in Iowa and New Hampshire. If you missed part of today's program, you may listen to it anytime on our website. It's wordforword.org. There, you may also subscribe to our free weekly podcast, hear all of our previous programs, and you'll also find full-length versions of all of the speeches we featured today. That's at wordforword.org. Next week on Word for Word, the flip side of today's program, we'll have the Democratic presidential candidates' stump speeches. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word for American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph and technical director Sam Keenan. Special thanks this week to New Hampshire Public Radio, Iowa Public Radio, and the website prx.org.
American Public Media.